Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we will look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We will begin with one of a number of congressmen and women who are boycotting Friday's inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th President of the United States, in part because of Trump's disrespectful tweets denigrating the civil rights icon Congressman John Lewis, who marched with King. Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd District and serves on the House Budget Committee and the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, joins us to discuss his reasons for boycotting Trump's inauguration and Congressman Lewis's recent remarks questioning Trump's legitimacy in light of recent revelations that Putin and the Russians meddled in our election to help elect Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. Then, with Donald Trump's meeting today with Martin Luther King's eldest son, we will discuss the incoming president's relations with African Americans following his public feud with Congressman Lewis, which adds to the bitter and distrustful mood amongst minorities in this country, many of whom were offended by Trump's racist remarks during the campaign and were alarmed by how much his candidacy drew support from white supremacists. Christopher Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington, who is the principal investigator of the multi-state survey on race and politics, joins us to assess the level of resistance already emerging against a Trump presidency. Then finally, we will speak with Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies and the graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins us to discuss what change is likely to come in a Trump administration and how much an attorney general who is a relic of the old South could turn back the clock in terms of civil and voting rights, along with the head of HUD who is against public housing and a labor secretary who is against workers' rights and a secretary of the Treasury who got rich by evicting people from their homes. And joining us now on this Martin Luther King Day is Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He serves on the House Budget Committee and the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. And he, along with 25 other members of Congress, are boycotting Friday's inauguration of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Ted Lieu.
Thank you, Ian.
And Congressman, the figure I just gave of 26 Congress members that are boycotting the inauguration, that came in at 8:30 this morning. I've been busy, so the number is growing. Do you have the latest number of how many?
I believe it's around 33 right now.
Wow, it's grown a lot today then. Give us your reasons for boycotting the inauguration of Donald Trump, the 45th President of the United States.
Based on what I know, I accept that Donald Trump won the Electoral College, but I cannot normalize him. I cannot normalize his unacceptable behavior, nor his racist, sexist, and bigoted statements. He's attacked Gold Star parents, veterans such as John McCain, Latinos, Muslim Americans, and now civil rights icon John Lewis. And the personal decision for me on whether to attend or not to attend the inauguration was fairly simple. Do I stand with Donald Trump? Or do I stand with John Lewis? I'm standing with John Lewis.
Well, John Lewis, his statement itself was, I don't think, was particularly controversial. Why do you think it caused so much backlash, particularly from Donald Trump and from Republicans in general? All he said was, I don't see the president-elect as a legitimate president. I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. The evidence for that is pretty clear, and it's growing, and I know there's a lot of denial happening from both Donald Trump and Republicans, but it just feels like the 900-pound gorilla in the room.
So this shows one of the problems with Donald Trump. Instead of addressing the very real issue of legitimacy, he went ahead and attacked the messenger. He attacked John Lewis. He attacked his district. And that is really, I think, what set off a lot of people and a lot of Democrats. John Lewis spilled blood for this country. He made America better. He is a civil rights icon. And for our next president to attack John Lewis this way was uncalled for. And I think that's one reason you're seeing the reaction you're seeing among not just Democrats, but also among Republicans. You have Republican members of Congress that have said that Trump should not have attacked John Lewis the way that he did.
Well, but even in his attack, he didn't make sense. And there was he said that his district was a disaster, and he should spend more time fixing his district. And he's portrayed so many African American districts as though they're parts of Aleppo in Syria or something, some hellhole, when in fact Congressman Lewis's district has a very, very wealthy enclave. It has Georgia Tech. It has the CDC. It has the world's largest airport. The president-elect doesn't even do his basic homework when he lashes out.
That's correct. Donald Trump makes stuff up, and that's a problem. And on January 20th, keep in mind, he becomes their establishment. So until then, it's easy to tweet and to make stuff up and to criticize others. But on January 20th, he's got to start governing. And the American people will know in a year and a half, is the country better off or worse off under his leadership? And then in 2 years, they have the chance to vote for all members of Congress, and it will be a referendum on Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
And again, I'm speaking with Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He serves on the House Budget Committee and the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. And he, along with 30. What was the number? Sorry.
33 was the last that I saw.
Okay. So he, along with 32 other members of Congress, are boycotting Friday's inauguration of Donald Trump's as the 45th president of the United States. Now, some people, of course, say, well, you know, if Donald Trump is impeached, if the links between Putin and he are proven, and there's certainly an awful lot out there, and in fact, the Inspector General of the Justice Department is pressuring the FBI. Apparently, the FBI director has been all too eager to release damaging information about Hillary Clinton on the eve of the election, but has apparently been stonewalling, releasing a lot of evidence of Russian involvement in helping Trump and hurting Hillary Clinton. There was a very contentious meeting, a briefing of the Congress the other day. Did you go to that briefing? Because your colleagues came out fuming.
I did. Let me put it this way. I have read the highly classified intelligence report. I also attend the classified briefing last week. And I can say that there is clear and convincing evidence to support the conclusions set forth in the unclassified version of the intelligence report. Namely, that Russia engaged in a massive cyber attack and influence campaign designed to undermine faith in the U.S. elections, to hurt Secretary Clinton, and to help Donald Trump's election chances.
And when do we accept that and have a full-blown investigation? If these are the facts, how can we proceed? I mean, Donald Trump himself should want this cloud over his legitimacy removed.
Absolutely. There are serious legitimacy issues surrounding Donald Trump, and he can fix it. So, for example, on January 20th, he's going to be in violation of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, Conflicts of Interest, because he has vast business holdings that he refuses to either divest or put in a blind trust. He can do that and fix that issue. He can release his tax returns. So we'll know if he has special interests in Russia or other business holdings the American people need to know about. He can address that issue. So far, he refuses to. And I am hopeful that Congress will do these investigations. And you do have bipartisan support now, at least in the U.S. Senate, to do some of these investigations.
And if indeed this smoking gun turns into not a mushroom cloud, as was the mantra during the build-up to the Iraq War, but an impeachable offense, which on the surface it is, then, of course, you would end up with Vice President Mike Pence as president. And give us a sense of the agenda that is already underway there in the U.S. Congress. I'm sure already the battle lines are drawn, are they not? I mean, not just the choice of people as heads of cabinet, all of whom, at least many of whom, are opposed to the very mission of the government department they head up, but already House Republicans are trying to undo a lot of the rules that basically regulate corporate America, and they're really attacking the regulatory process itself. They got a number of bills aimed at ensuring that would undo protections that we have for water, food safety, and other things that are vital. They claim to want to reform the rulemaking process to make regulators more accountable, but it seems that this is going to actually give them more ability to repeal existing rules and block new ones. It does seem that they're very determined. So how do you, as a congressman, Congressman Liu, stop this assault, which is happening in your very committee, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform?
There is a law of physics that I believe applies equally in politics, and that is for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And we are the reaction. You're going to see House Democrats, you're going to see people all across America reacting to their insane agenda that the Republicans are putting forth. They have introduced bills to cut Social Security. Speaker Ryan talks about privatizing Medicare. They just voted this past week to repeal the Affordable Care Act without a plan. That's going to cause chaos in the insurance markets, increase everybody's health insurance costs, and it's going to cause a lot of people to lose their health insurance. So we're going to fight back as hard as we can. And I know that the majority of American people are on our side.
But in terms of bills like the Regulatory Accountability Act, where they could basically get rid of all the existing rules and kill rules simply by doing nothing, that appears to be the ruse. And they've pulled off some parliamentary maneuvers to kill Obamacare by avoiding or preventing the Democrats from using the filibuster in the Senate. So this is a very aggressive agenda out of the gate, isn't it?
Absolutely. But keep in mind, through their parliamentary procedures, they can only do a certain amount of destroying the Affordable Care Act. So there's a lot of it they can't touch through this arcane process known as budget reconciliation. But they can stop the funding for it. So at the end of the day, you're going to have no funding for this health insurance law that's going to cause extreme chaos in the markets. And the American people are going to know a year and a half from now, did their health insurance premiums go up or go down? Do they have health coverage or they don't? And then in 2 years, the American people will be able to vote for every member of Congress, and that will also be a referendum on Donald Trump.
So in the last minute, Congressman Ted Liu, what do we as citizens and listeners do who didn't vote for this man? 3 million more of us voted for Hillary Clinton, and many of us are alarmed at the idea that, frankly, Vladimir Putin is pulling the strings.
All right. Write letters to the editor in the Washington Post and New York Times and other newspapers. Call Speaker Ryan's office. Go to rallies and marches. Keep in mind, on day one, the Republicans tried to gut the Office of Independent Ethics, and they were stopped because the American people rose up and said that was a bad idea. And 24 hours later, the Republicans reverse. So when people stand up and rise, we can stop stupid, unconstitutional, crazy ideas. And I look forward to working with people to do just that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Congressman Ted Liu.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Congressman Ted Liu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He serves on the House Budget Committee and the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. And he, along with 32 other members of Congress, are boycotting Friday's inauguration of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the incoming president's relations with African Americans following his public feud with Congressman Lewis. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7. And joining us now on this Martin Luther King Day is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator for the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and is the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
It's good to be back. Ian, I would say Happy New Year's, but we all know what's about to happen this weekend. So,
we just spoke with a congressman who is boycotting the inauguration, along with a growing number of Democratic lawmakers. So it's not like everybody's accepting this person as being a legitimate president, even though, as John Lewis said, he is not the... He doesn't think he's legitimate because of the Russian hacking. But, of course, it's possible to have two thoughts in your head at the same time. In other words, some people can feel he's not legitimate, but he is the legitimate president of the United States.
That is very true. Well said, Ian. Well said.
So we should proceed from that, I think. So what did you make of Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest son visiting Trump Tower today, and in the context of so many people, as I mentioned, boycotting the inauguration because of Trump's recent remarks that were considered disrespectful towards Congressman John Lewis?
Well, to be honest, Ian, I found this so distasteful, I couldn't even, I refused to watch it or to find out what happened. I just find it utterly distasteful that these black folks, you know, him, Jim Brown, I mean, permitting themselves to be photo op with this guy. Because he's not going, he may lure them there with the promise of him listening to the grievances of the black community, but basically, he's not going to do it. His track record doesn't suggest otherwise. And so it's like, for what purpose are they going there? I don't understand it.
Well, as an African-American, what was your response to Trump's continued and repeated remarks on the campaign trail that portrayed African-American communities across the country as war zones, as appalling, dangerous, decayed? He then, of course, in his tweet on Saturday to Congressman Lewis, who was brutally beaten, as we all know, on the Bloody Sunday March in 1965 in Selma, Alabama, he accused the congressman of being all talk, and he should stop complaining and focus on fixing his district that's falling apart and crime infested. Now, that's the way he's described an awful lot of African-American communities, as though they're just absolutely no-go zones, you know, like some part of Syria. But what's extraordinary about his attack on Congressman Lewis in this context of his district being crime infested, Lewis's district actually includes a very wealthy part of his district, an enclave called Buckhead, the world's busiest airport, Hartsfield-Jackson, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Georgia Institute of Technology. So clearly Trump is wrong on characterizing Congressman Lewis's district as falling apart. But what about your experience in African-American neighborhoods of this country, and how do they respond to the characterization by this soon-to-be president that they're living in squalor?
Well, first of all, this ass clown needs to read. He really needs to do some reading. I mean, for him to, first of all, to characterize all black neighborhoods like he did is just riven and shot through with arrogance as well as ignorance. So, like you correctly cited, Ian, I mean, Buckhead is one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the South writ large, much less Atlanta. And as you correctly pointed out, which includes Georgia Tech which is one of the most prestigious institutes of technology in the United States, right up there with MIT and Caltech, if you will. So first of all, he is factually incorrect. Second of all, if we want to think about the policies, to the extent that black neighborhoods, you know, are relatively deprived, we have to think about the institutions and policies that made this possible. Capitalism was a big culprit in this, with deindustrialization and the hollowing out of the quote-unquote what they call inner city these days. So capitalism is at the root of this if we really want to go there. So Trump needs to read some history. Plus, beyond that, even if we go in between to the neighborhoods of, you know, the black middle class, right? The black middle class has fortunately been able to expand somewhat in the last 30 or 40 years, right? So for him to say that all black neighborhoods are what are the neighborhoods that we saw on, let's say, for example, the sitcom of the 1970s, Good Times, is just blithely ignorant as well as irredeemably arrogant.
Well, how much do African Americans, obviously with the exception of people that you mentioned earlier, that you feel are used as props, and certainly the nominee to be the head of Housing and Urban Development, who seems to know nothing about the government department that he's heading up, could be described in that way. But given that that's a pattern here, does the African American community at large, not the token people that we're talking about here, do they understand this man's history? Particularly when Congressman Lewis was getting beaten almost to death by the Alabama state troopers in 1965, Donald Trump was avoiding the Vietnam War by claiming he had a bone spur. And of course, our press never asked him about that during the entire campaign, but they hounded Bill Clinton and George W. Bush over the same issue. So this guy's gotten a break. But only a year or two later did Donald Trump and his father face a federal lawsuit for housing discrimination, which of course brings us back to his choice for HUD, HUD, this neurosurgeon who is entirely out of his depth and doesn't even believe in public housing.
Right. No, I mean, so I think most black people are very cognizant of the history of John Lewis, you know, and his sacrifice on Bloody Sunday, March 7th, 1965, on the Emmett Pettus Bridge. Most of us, maybe we don't know it in that greater detail, but most recognize that he was part of Dr. Martin Luther King's, he was part of his crew or his cadre. So most people know that. But very few people, I think, know, black or white, unless they are really, a policy wonk, if you will, that are cognizant of the fact, beyond the sort of black educated class, are cognizant of the fact that, yeah, that Trump, A, you know, was a draft dodger, and B, only a couple years after that, as you so aptly noted, was part of a federal civil rights lawsuit, you know, that claimed and that proved, you know, that there was some discrimination, you know, in one of Fred Trump's, many apartment dwellings. And this was actually proven. I think, if memory serves me correct, they pled no contest. And that's how that was eventually resolved.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, Professor of Social Justice and Political Science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, and his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. But what is going on here in the sense that after Trump tweeted this, what people considered, and many people considered to be insulting remarks to Congressman Lewis in response for Lewis on Meet the Press, saying that he wasn't sure that this was a legitimate president, given what we know about Russian meddling, hacking, and perhaps Putin's own involvement in helping elect Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. All of that's pretty clear, and I don't know why more people aren't asking that obvious question. But nevertheless, it obviously got under Trump's skin, and as I mentioned, he tweeted about Lewis's district being crime-infested. But then he then went on the next day, Trump tweeted that Lewis should finally focus on the burning, crime-infested inner cities of the U.S. So he's not letting this thing go. And my only conclusion is that this is a kind of coded way of saying that African-Americans in this country just don't live a kind of the lives that the rest of us do. They're living in another universe, one that he describes that has little to do with reality, even though, you know, clearly you have problems in some of the inner cities, particularly with gangs, and Chicago being a glaring example. It's as though he's trying to paint the African Americans in a way that is fundamentally racist.
That's precisely what he's doing. There's no doubt about that. That is really sort of really naked on his face. But he is right in that we do live in separate countries. right? You have a country, for white folks, and then we have a country for everybody else. So he's not incorrect in his assertion there. He is, however, normatively incorrect in a sense that if you're correct, and I think you're right, in that he's trying to paint us as a community as less than or less than deserving, he's trying to remove us from the American political community. And, you know, for his followers, you know, that's no great surprise. And for those of us who are critics of him, that is no great surprise at all. But the problem is that if this continues unabated, if he continues furthermore and more injurious, I think, to continue to co-opt, and yes, I did say co-opt, these black celebrities, then what that's going to do is it's going to permit him to shield himself from even more criticism and biting and harsher criticism, because he can say, on the one hand, you know, black folks, they aren't like the rest of us, but on the other hand, you can't really criticize me because guess what? I'm talking to what's the guy? Steve Harvey. Oh my gosh, Jim Brown. I'm really surprised at Jim Brown and Ray Lewis, because I'm talking to these guys. That can't make me a racist. That does not permit you to call me a racist, because I find myself in the company of these people, right? But at the same time, he's also criticizing the vast majority of black folks in very racist terms. I just find, you know, the fact that these black celebrities, and I stress celebrities because I don't think you see any politicians or anybody with any real intellectual heft, you know, that are in his company beyond Ben Carson, but his heft is really confined to, you know, medicine. You don't find anybody else in his company. So then perhaps there's a reason for that, that these other people know that these intellectual leaders of the black community, they know that this guy could do something for us, but the ways in which he's characterizing our community as a whole, you know, makes it such that he can't do anything for us given who his supporters are. So I just find it's extremely problematic that you have black celebrities that are basically vouching for Trump, and they're inoculating him to the criticism that he so richly deserves.
So when you talk about the trouble you have with Trump supporters, Chris Barker, are you referring to the fact that a lot of white supremacists were drawn to his campaign? I mean, what...
Yeah, I mean, so look, one of the things that I'm working on another book with, I'm working on two other books right now, one of which deals with the idea that basically Trump just took advantage of the political anxiety that Tea Party supporters have. As a matter of fact, what I show in a separate study is that 83% of people who supported the Tea Party also support Trump. So we're basically talking about the same people, white, middle class, middle aged, mainly male, native born, homophobic, xenophobic people. These are the same people that supported Trump. And for those people to say that, oh, it's just really about, the white working class, that's a bunch of bull. It wasn't just about the white working class. The white working class only constitutes 36% of the electorate, and he didn't win 100% of those, right? So Trump won 49% of college-educated white folks. So for people to say that, oh, it's just really about, you know, populism and about, you know, this white working class, that's a bunch of hooey. I can't believe it's hogwash. And the problem with that is, Ian, what is so problematic is that the policy prescription suggests that as soon as the economy gets better for them, right, as soon as these elites are taken out or they're neutralized, then, you know, these white folks won't have the same bigoted responses that they have now, which is a bunch of bull, simply because you have so many middle class and better and white folks who are doing better who voted for Trump. So these policy suggestions or prescriptions that flow from this analysis are completely and utterly false.
Well, that was one thing that occurred to me during the campaign, that the people at the rallies weren't, you know, like the Duck Dynasty people from the backwoods. They were, right, you know, middle-class, white, educated, you know, reasonably prosperous people. So what does that tell you? I mean, does that mean that racism is alive and well?
Well, that tells me, well, racism, sexism, homophobia. Look, for people to reduce this to the Duck Dynasty people, which I really like that, but I'll go you one even further. This is not Jethro and Billy Joe Jim Bob out there hooking up with their sheep in the shed. It's not those people, right? There are some of those people, but it's not confined to that class of people. So the problem is, once again, what's so dangerous about this is the idea that the policy prescription is that, hey, once things get better with the economy, you know, once these people aren't so economic, economically anxious, you know, that things will work out and we won't have this, you know, bigoted, divided America. That's what that policy prescription suggests, is that that's going to happen once things even out. But the fact of the matter is we have people who are doing quite very well, thank you, who still subscribe to this. So that means that racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, it's not going anyplace anytime soon.
Well, the problem with Trump is that it's hard to discern whether he believes in anything. I mean, he does things, he says things, a lot of which has been really horrible and disgusting and insulting. But, for example, the Attorney General nominee that Representative John Lewis testified against, Jeff Sessions, he's obviously a relic of the Old South. But the reason he was chosen by Trump is because he was the first and only senator to support Trump. The same goes for the governor of Texas. He chose him because he was the first of the other rivals in the Republican presidential race to support him, as was Dr. Carson. So this is what it seems to be about. It's about this man's massive ego. If you support me, you get a job. Otherwise, your history, you know.
Look, let's call this what it is. He is a narcissistic, egotistical mess, right? I mean, seriously. I don't think this man even really wanted to be president. I think he was even surprised that he got elected. I don't think there's any way in the world he ever thought this would happen. And I'm sure in his heart of hearts, if such as it is, that he's probably saying, damn, I can't believe these fucking idiots voted for me. He does not want this job.
Right.
He does not want to be president. Look, I don't think, quite honestly, Ian, I don't think anyone with a Wharton degree at the University of Pennsylvania is that stupid. He's being deliberately provocative. He said and did everything he could not to get elected.
Well, that's an interesting interpretation. And yet he did. Now, so what happened? I mean, we know what a lousy campaign she ran. We know about the FBI director. We know about Putin's meddling. But at the end of the day, still enough Americans voted for this guy to get him over the top.
I think he underestimated the stupidity of a lot of these white folks. He didn't think it was possible for him to get elected. Seriously, the man has a degree from, you say what you want about, you know, how childish and how petulant he is. The man at the end of the day still has a degree from Wharton. He can't be that stupid. He did not want to get elected. I think most people would agree, at least on the left, that this is a publicity ploy, that it began as a publicity ploy, and his ego wouldn't let him drop out of the race because he had to win. And so it's akin to a little boy, you know, who's chasing a tiger who finally catches it by the tail. And it's like, hey, what the f*** do I do with this now?
Well, except that the tiger happens to be all of us, and we're in this boat.
So I put this on Facebook recently after the whole scandal started really leaking out about him in Russia. First I said, you know, Trump and hookers, damn, I'm shocked, right? And then the second one was like, you know what? Here we have a white man who's getting blackmailed, you know, from hooking up with Russian hookers, right? Who's about to move into the White House.
Without his wife.
Without his wife. And then I finished, I said, if this weren't so tragic for the rest of us, this would be funny.
Well, I appreciate the effort at lightening the load here, Chris, on this day. But we are, of course, reminded of Martin Luther King on this day, and Representative John Lewis did tweet, and the tweet being the way that people communicate now politically. He said, Dr. King taught us to recognize the dignity and worth of every human being. He was the moral compass of our nation. He marched for us. He protested for us. He went to jail for us. He gave his life for us. We honor Dr. King's legacy through service to our community and adherence to the philosophy and discipline of nonviolence. Our nation has at times created and enforced unjust laws. It's up to people of conscience to expose such injustice through nonviolent means. So let's end on that positive note.
Let's do that, Ian. Thank you again for the invitation. And please don't hesitate to call me back.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's a principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing what change is likely to come in terms of race relations in a Trump administration.
Damn, can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand this pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset, and Tennessee's made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi gone there. I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day is Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Butler's latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthea Butler.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And you marched today, right?
I did. I marched in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact.
And just briefly describe the event, if you don't mind.
Sure. It was really great. It was a big coalition of different organizations here, some religious, some political, some educational, that went from Independence Mall today to Mother Bethel AME Church, which is the home church of the first black denomination in the United States. And there were a series of speeches and people rallying, including Sonia Sanchez, the poet, who, if you know your civil rights history, hung out a lot with Malcolm X. And there were probably about an hour and a half of speeches and then breakout sessions for different churches and synagogues around town to help people start to train in different areas for getting ready and prepared for the Trump administration and what is about to happen in America.
Well, let's talk about what is about to happen, at least as much as we can tell. I think the important thing is to not so much what Donald Trump says, but what he does. And so far, you have to look at the people he's appointed to run the various government departments. He's got a relic of the old South in as Attorney General, who could well turn back the clock on civil and voting rights. He's got the head of HUD, who's against public housing, a Labor Secretary who's against workers' rights, and a Secretary of the Treasury who got rich by evicting people from their homes. So what is the mood amongst people, and what do they think they're preparing for?
Well, I think everybody knows that we're preparing for the absolute worst, first of all. I would say the mood is a combination of resolute, ready to fight, and utter despair that our nation is being turned over to somebody who is basically incompetent and wants to spend more time on Twitter than he does with policy, and the policies that he has sounds like he's Putin's best friend. So the mood is dark but hopeful in the sense that people are really coming together, and I think that's a good sign.
Well, the holiday itself, of course, is not without controversy. I mean, first of all, Congressman John Lewis, who's, by the way, boycotting the inauguration, he first proposed a Martin Luther King holiday bill back in 1968, and it wasn't until 1983 that the measure passed. And it was filibustered in the Senate by Jesse Helms, and eventually it was signed by President Reagan. So, and that was, by the way, in 1986. So it took a while. And what's your sense of whether it's been expropriated in a way? I mean, I noticed, for example, that Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest son met with Donald Trump today.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Let me say this. I think that, you know, this fight first for the holiday and then the ramifications from the holiday, just to give you an example of how much this is still needs to change in Biloxi, Mississippi, they actually didn't call this Martin Luther King Day. They called it Great Americans Day until everybody started yelling them at Twitter, and they realized that they needed to call this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. In other places in the South, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the celebration of his birthday, is sandwiched in between Confederate holidays. And so while on the one hand, many of us have the day off, we do have days of service, we have parades, we have all these things to honor Dr. King, the fact of the matter is that there's a good segment of America that really doesn't still want to do it. And I think that's a real shame, first of all. And then secondarily, the ways in which this whole thing rolled out between Trump and John Lewis right at the start of the holiday weekend is just one more signal of his racist itinerary and his racist core. There is no discounting the fact that this man is ahistorical, and the ways in which he puts his history together is to the denigration of anyone who is not a white male or rich. So I think that we're in for a fight. We are in for someone who has no understanding of American history or what patriotism is or what democracy is. And if you can besmirch a civil rights leader on the weekend of the Martin Luther King holiday, a man who marched with King, I mean, even the most ignorant racist knows not to touch that. So where does that leave Trump?
Well, you mentioned his relationship with Vladimir Putin, which is still yet to be fully examined, and it's becoming less and less likely to be examined because a lot of pressure is being put on the intelligence community to shut up. The British Prime Minister is trying to muzzle the British intelligence service. The MI6 intelligence officer who prepared the dossier, a digest of which was briefed to both President Obama and President-elect Trump, he's in hiding in fear of his life. And yet what Representative John Lewis said to Meet the Press the other day was, "I don't see the president-elect as a legitimate president. I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton." Frankly, that strikes me as being entirely factual. I don't see what... Do you understand why it's controversial?
Well, it's controversial anytime a black man speaks the truth in America. Well, that's probably first of all. I hate to say it like that, but and some people might think I'm pulling the race card, but it's just the truth. I think that he made a clear, succinct statement about where we are, and that it is a statement that you cannot ignore, first off. And then second, this is what incensed Donald Trump so much. I mean, he knows that this is true, and I've never seen anything like this, you know, in all of my years, that we have an incoming president. To speak about Russia in this way is just, it's beyond compare. You can't even begin to imagine this. I don't think that any, even the most, loose Republican back, even 5 or 10 years ago would have spoken this way. And so I ask the same question as John Lewis. I don't think he's legitimate at all. I think he's an illegitimate president. And I think that we put the world in great peril by putting this man in office on Friday.
Well, curiously enough, though, the criticism I get for even covering this story, which is hardly pretty unavoidable, really, it's been going on for some time, and for the life of me, I don't understand why members of the American left are so resistant to the idea that Putin and the Russians played an active role in tipping the scales for Trump and hurting Hillary Clinton. And I understand, people's skepticism about this, the CIA and the intelligence community broadly, because of the weapons of mass destruction scandal over the Iraq war. But they seem to forget that really was mostly pushed by Dick Cheney, who was basically using his political muscle to force the CIA and those members within the intelligence community who folded under the pressure to produce the intelligence that they wanted. And exactly the same thing is happening now, that the Republicans are leaning on the CIA to shut up, and the new guy is a Republican partisan, Pompeo, and he can't wait to get in there and get everybody on side and stop the drip, drip, drip. So I'm not even sure we're ever going to get to the bottom of it, frankly.
No, we may not. But, I mean, I think the difference is now, and this is what, my hope is that there's enough social media and other ways that if things need to come out, they can come out. It will take a lot for them to stop it once it gets out. It's just like the dossier that came out from the agent for MI6. Basically, it got out and everybody was able to see all of the things that, you know, whether or not they were true, it caused great consternation and conversation for everyone. But I think this gets to something deeper, and I want to touch on something you said about liberals not sort of understanding what this is. I think the bigger issue with the American public right now is that there's a sense in which they can't believe it could happen here. And we've been sold all these kinds of stories about how great America is, democracy, we'll never be taken over, we'll never do this, we'll never be that, and it's actually happening before our eyes. And so the sense in which, you know, the urgency that I and others feel, we seem to be in the minority because other people are willing to sleepwalk right into this thing that is going to be, you know, a disaster on Friday, the inauguration of an illegitimate president who did not get enough votes, who had less than 2 million votes, and somehow,
3 million.
Strangely enough,
3 million.
Yeah, 3 million, thank you. Yeah. And, you know, somehow strangely won the electoral vote. And I still don't understand that. We still don't have explanations for that. And with everything that has happened, not just, you know, Russian interference, but the ways in which the Voting Rights Act has been stripped and people were unable to vote on Election Day, those kinds of issues, you bring that all together, I don't think that this man is the rightful president of the United States. And I may be in the minority on that, but I think that history will prove me down the line that I was right.
And again, I'm speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Butler's latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. And just in terms of the subject of your latest book, it is pretty mind-boggling that the religious right totally got behind this thrice-divorced libertine owner of gambling dens who coveted his neighbor's
wife posed naked.
Yeah, who coveted his neighbor's wife, according to his own words from the Access Hollywood tape, and also felt that he could grab women by the genitals with impunity. But nevertheless, they bought on, and clearly there was a deal made. The deal, the art of the deal man, made a deal with the Christian right. You give me your votes, and you can have your vice president, and that's how we've got Mike Pence.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just Mike Pence. It's Betsy DeVos. It's, you know, it's Flynn. It's all of these people who are theocrats on the right. And actually, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, well, if, you know, Trump gets impeached, then we'll have Pence, and Pence is worse. And that may be true to a certain extent because he could be worse. I mean, I don't think he'll blow up the world like I think Trump might. But I do think that we have a unique peril, not just with Trump, but with the kinds of people from the right that he's putting in. And so the kinds of things that you see in the kind of appointments like, you know, John Hagee, or I believe, oh no, it's Mike Huckabee who's going to be an ambassador to Israel or something like that. The way he's pulled out all the ambassadors and told them they have to be out by January 20th and they can't be in the embassies. It's just mind-boggling, and you have to understand that he's got a list of people that he wants in places, and a lot of that payback is going to be to those, religious right figures that got him the vote.
Well, that's the payback for that deal that he made with Pence and the religious right. But the rest of at least a lot of the choices are pure ego-driven, because these are people like Senator Sessions, who was the first and only senator to support him. So his payback is, you support me, I'm a great guy, therefore you're qualified. I mean, it's unbelievably vacuous.
Yeah. And
that same goes for the governor of Texas and the head of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Carson.
Yes.
It's entirely to do with how they dealt with him in the presidential primaries as opposed to whether or not they're qualified. So it's an ego-driven operation more than anything. It has little to do with competence. And that's what's scary. These people are just so appalling. Somebody out the other day, Anthea, pointed out to me that I was interviewing the editor-in-chief of the Foreign Policy magazine, said there are more people in the Trump cabinet who have been accused of spousal abuse than there are women.
Yeah, well, that says everything, right? That says everything. I mean, but again, it's indicative of, you know, the kind of world that Trump sees himself. He sees that men are superior, women are inferior, unless they have enough money to be on the same plane with him, like Betsy DeVos. and you pick, you know, your cronies. You don't pick people who are qualified. Being qualified has nothing to do with this. I mean, basically, he's picking a cabal of people who are going to rape the government. I mean, so that same kind of crassness that he has about grabbing women and all the other kinds of things, he's going to do the same thing to the American government. He's going to take whatever he can get. He's already doing it to businesses by threatening them. You know, the newest one on the list, I believe, is BMW, that he said he was going to put sanctions against them if they didn't do some kind of, you know, auto plant here. He has made stocks go down. I mean, this is just, I basically said to someone, I said, it is like America is dating an abusive guy and now is getting ready to marry him, and all of us are screaming, don't do it. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're going to marry the abuser on Friday.
Well, yeah, it's a bit like having a blind date in Las Vegas and waking up in bed with a stranger who you suddenly find out you're married to.
Yeah, exactly, but except it wasn't fun, right. You know?
Well, let me just talk about the idea that there's so many people in this country, in particularly amongst minority communities, who are alarmed and distrustful because many were offended by Trump's racist remarks during the campaign and were alarmed by how much his candidacy drew support from white supremacists. His constant reference to black communities in this country as being war zones and absolutely horrible, decrepit, decaying, and even he referred to John Lewis's, Congressman Lewis's district down in Georgia in that way. But of course, it turns out that he's got a wealthy enclave, but the major airport in the world, Georgia Tech, and the CDC are all in his district. So this is a man who doesn't do his homework. But he also really, right out of the gate, insulted the Latinos, literally, as he announced his presidency. And that was very calculated and very cynical. So what's the chances of a coalition of people in this country who've been insulted by this man getting their act together? I'm talking about African-Americans, Latinos, women, people with disabilities. The list could go on.
I think it's high. I think this is a moment in which we have to understand that we cannot be splintered apart. In other words, the internecine battles that have happened between groups sometimes, whether that's been, I'm thinking about both black and white feminists have had issues. This is a crisis moment, and this is an unprecedented threat. And I think about the civil rights movement and how you had Catholic priests and nuns and rabbis and, you know, Orthodox priests. You had blacks, you had whites, you had everybody, LGBT folks. All these people got together to help out for, you know, African-Americans and civil rights. And now we all have to pull together in these different disparate groups to save our nation. It's a crucial time because it's not just about, you know, overturning some kind of injustice that has been a law. It's about overturning someone who is basically threatening the Constitution, doesn't understand the Constitution, doesn't understand democratic life, and is ready to sell us down the river to Russia. I mean, it's even past the kinds of, you know, basic things that we'd all fight about. And we haven't brought this up yet, but I think one other place that everybody can get together on this is healthcare. And I think that's a very big moment with this, you know, them trying to take down the ACA and, you know, even the people who voted for Trump not understanding that Obamacare is the same thing as the Affordable Care Act. And they don't realize that the man that they voted for is about to take away everything that they need. And so the very lives of people, not just because they're out in the street and protesting, but they're just doing their everyday jobs and they can't get health care. I mean, this is throwing us back to the Stone Ages with, you know, landed gentry getting all the money. And I think that's the reason why we began this whole country in the first place, was we wanted to get away from people like that.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Anthea Butler, in terms of Martin Luther King Jr.'s day, which we're observing today, and in the context of mobilizing across, you know, the curse of the American left has been identity politics, and in many ways racism was reinvented by the Republicans as a means to essentially keep it alive, because the more you distract people with racism and divisive politics and dog whistles, the less chance there is that they'll wake up together and recognize that they all have so much more in common than they have that divides them. But that said, it would seem that for the Latinos to understand Martin Luther King on this this day, in a 1967 speech, King declared, "Our loyalties must be ecumenical rather than national. Instead of policing borders and nations should develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole. The alternative is unacceptable. History is cluttered with the wreckage of nations and individuals that pursued this self-defeating path of hate."
Well, I think King is right. I mean, I think part of it is about, I mean, there's two prongs of things happening with all of this. One is, you know, obviously we need to be fighting for human rights in the midst of all of this. And there are people's rights that are going to be trampled on when this administration comes into power come January the 20th. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I think that the thing that I've always been amazed about with King and other civil rights leaders is their constant referral back to the founders and what that was supposed to be. And so in a sense, we have to be about people, but our nation represents something too. It has, you know, give us, you're tired, you're poor, you're hungry, all of this stuff, whether we're talking about immigrants or others. This has always been a place where we wanted to open the doors to people so that they can come and make themselves what they wanted to be. And I think that even King, in a sense, would say at this moment that, you know, there's a blank check, it's been marked as insufficient funds. We haven't gotten it as African Americans. We haven't gotten it as so many of us. And now to see such a person come into political power with a group of people who don't think that anybody else should get political power unless they're able to pull up themselves up by the bootstraps, I think is a travesty and tramples upon King's legacy. I don't understand why Martin Luther King III decided to see Trump today. I wish he had not. That is a photo op that he did not need to do. But I think that the King family themselves have some answering to about how they've kept the legacy of their father. So that's a whole nother kind of conversation. But I do think that this is a moment in which all of us as a people, whether we're American citizens or not, have to come together to stand against something that is a unique peril to us as a not just a people, but as an entire world.
Anthea Butler, I thank you very much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day holiday.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.